Hello, my name's Ben Harmon and I'm the director of Stills. We're a registered charity and a centre for photography based in Edinburgh. To find out more about our work and how to support us, please visit stills.org. You're listening to Photography Down the Line, a podcast aimed at sharing the ideas of artists, photographers and other people from the photography sector that we're in touch with. For this episode, I spoke to the artist Caroline Douglas about her artistic practice and her research into the role of women in early Scottish photography. Thanks for listening. Hello, am I speaking to Caroline Douglas?
Yes, you are.
Hi, Caroline. Thanks so much for taking the time to do this. Just to sort of set the scene a bit, where are you and what might I be interrupting with this call?
I'm at home in North East London. And this being Thursday is actually a work day at Glasgow School of Art, and I'm doing some marking, so this is a very welcome distraction. yeah, I've been there since last September. I'm working with the fourth year fine art photography students, yeah, which I really love. But yeah, yesterday was a studio day, and I'm sort of pleased to be back in the building at the Royal College of Art and making my own work.
Yeah, I'm really interested in that. It seems from a distance to me that you've got that balance just right of your academic work, making work as an artist, as making photographic work, practicing artist, and the teaching as well. But is it a struggle to get that balance?
Yeah, that's very nice of you to say so. It doesn't feel like that on the other side. Yeah, I mean, certainly the format of the practice-based PhD is something that's working well for me, in that, you know, my art practice and my studies are completely intertwined at the moment. And it means that there isn't much space for making work outside of that project. But yeah, it feels like a good balance. Mm. And the teaching really is great. It always feeds into the work and vice versa.
And we'll probably come back to your PhD. I wanted to ask you about that. But first of all, I wondered how the events of the last couple of years have impacted on you and your work in particular.
Oddly enough, in 2020, I was actually preparing myself for a year of isolation of quite a different form. My second son was born at the very start of the pandemic, which was almost exactly 2 years ago. So I was actually gearing up for a year of maternity leave, and I suppose some of the isolation that this can bring. Yeah, obviously the complete joy too, but as you know, it's tough at times, the balance between work and parenting. But yeah, anyway, this didn't happen quite as planned, and you know, I knew in my decision to have a second child it was going to mean a break from my practice and my studies, and I'd really made some peace with that in a way that I perhaps hadn't managed the first time round. When my first son Ezra was born, I was granted a scholarship at St Andrews Uni that was working with the early photography collections there too. Incredible. But I guess I felt a sort of rush back to prove a point to myself, and yeah, I wasn't going to do that this time. But yeah, anyway, before the pandemic, I think I had been planning the maternity leave to be some sort of catch up on reading and testing of ideas, but lockdown meant that none of that was possible. So we're in a small two-bed flat here in London. So with a toddler and a baby, none of that was really conducive to making work. And my partner was also teaching throughout in our bedroom. So it was more of a case of attending to jigsaws, putting on CBeebies, providing perpetual snacks, putting any ambitions I had for my own work just on hold for a while. But yeah, I mean, that accounts for 1 year. The past year has been quite productive. And although I'm still mostly working from home, I did do a couple of placements, one at the V&A here in London and the other about in Edinburgh at the Collective. So these have both sort of eased me back into my practice and had me thinking about my research in new ways.
And to rewind a little bit, and for those, I'm assuming a lot of people might not know too much about you. Could you talk a little bit about, so going back to studying photography, and you were at ECA and then studying photography and then an MFA at Glasgow School of Art. Could you say a little bit about how those courses and perhaps being in those different cities, Edinburgh and Glasgow, sort of shaped your work at that time?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, winding back, I went to art school straight from high school. So yeah, it was my BA at ECA, as you mentioned, and then the MFA at Glasgow School of Art. And actually in between those two degrees, I did a lot of teaching. And it was, my BA was a photography degree, and upon graduating from that, it was actually stills that gave me my first, if you like, artistic experience outside of higher education. And there I was taken on as one of the three, what were known as the Recreate Artist Residents. The others were based at the Sculpture Workshop and the Printmakers.
Was this round about 2008, something like
yes,
that?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And yeah, it was great. It was really new territory for me, I guess, as a sort of recent undergrad, a recent graduate. And that was a role that was about widening participation, working with different community groups across Edinburgh. And it was a great way of taking some of the skills that I'd acquired in my BA and bringing them to my teaching that was also new to me. And it was, yeah, really an informative educational experience. And I think I struggled a bit creatively to sort of find my feet. The focus was always, as it ought to have been, you know, on the participants. But it was later on the MFA in Glasgow that I really, I guess I realised the profound effect that residency had actually had on my practice. And it was in one case that I was working with a group of people that had different degrees of visual impairment. And the workshop leader, Rosita McKenzie, she's really a remarkable woman.
Yeah.
And she's fully blind, and she would rely heavily upon the verbal descriptions that us tutors gave to these photographs that were being made. And you know, I was really fascinated the way that the sort of sighted participants, if you like, the way that we described the photographs in what we thought was the most objective way possible. But I was really sort of struck by the failure of language and the limits of photography. So it was in that experience that later on for my MFA, in my degree show, in fact, I made a video work, actually in collaboration with Rosita. And in the video, she reads aloud a Braille edition of Playboy magazine. And she was trained as a tutor of Braille. And I think it kind of shows in the video, because her fingers glide across the page at real speed. And she has this fluency reading the passages aloud to the camera. And I felt, although it's a video work, it was really this sort of interrogation of the photograph, where there was this sort of tactile or haptic encounter with the photograph that I was trying to show. Something I'd always been interested in finding ways to represent. And I suppose in some ways it's something that's still driving my work at the moment, the encounter that we have with the photograph and the voyeurism that the viewer brings. But yeah, just sort of returning to your question about these experiences, I really, both at ECA and GSA, I learned so much from my tutors and my peers, and just feel very lucky, really, at the support that sort of continued on past my studies. And David Williams, Nikki Bird, who I actually met through Stills, even today through to my PhD supervisor, Rebecca Fortnum. You know, I've really just felt a support and just a real sort of value in the and positive experience from the education systems that I've been through.
Yeah, it's hearing you talk about the Braille Playboy project, which I think was called Playboy Entertainment for Men. And
that's right.
I should point out also that this is the videos on your website, carolinedouglasphotography.co.uk. And Rosita, I know, describes herself as a blind photographer. She's based in Edinburgh. Hadn't thought about it before, but this idea of touching of using brushing your fingers or hand across a photograph in the way that Rosita does with the Braille. You know, it's something you is an immediately a sort of you know, something you just don't do to photographs. We're taught kind of not to touch them, you know, to hold them by the edges, and this sort of fragility, which is quite interesting. And it occurred to me when you were talking about that. I'm curious about the MFA in Glasgow. I imagine you were amongst a lot of students that were using photography, but perhaps wouldn't describe themselves as photographers. But were you at that point, were you already sort of thinking that photography was the medium you were going to concentrate on, you know, the history, the issues around the medium, as well as perhaps making your own photographs? Or was it at ECA that you thought, no, this is the kind of medium that holds the most interest for me?
Yeah, I think working, just thinking how best to answer this. Like the photograph and the pursuit of photography is what drives me. That's never in question. I suppose in more recent years I've just found there to be sort of, I've found it easier to articulate my ideas in other forms, but ultimately what I'm always exploring, the photograph is the starting point. Do you know, I've actually been trying to locate when I sort of first developed that sort of passion for photography, and even just sort of thinking about our discussion today, and I think, you know, the city films that my mum used to set up and project in our hallway, you know, these are some of the most cherished childhood memories. And I know it sounds really cheesy, but I think stripping it all back, like, I really just adore looking at those, and I love to make them, and the whole process of making and thinking about them, the discussions around them, and that's always what drives me. And I get really gripped by, I suppose, the discussions between what's actually seen, what's been looked at, and what's been said and spoke about. So I guess it's the way that photographs provide this social function as well as an aesthetic one. And it's kind of ironic, like, the more that I study them, the fewer pictures I take. Maybe like many, you know, the camera that's in my hand most of all is my phone. And during COVID, I took hundreds of pictures of my kids, and that was just the camera that was within arm's length. So there's probably something full circle going on there with my childhood memories.
Yeah. But I think, like you said, you feel that you can best articulate yourself through images rather than, say, writing.
Yeah, definitely. Which is one of the challenges the PhD brings, where the two need to coexist.
Of course, yeah.
But I think I'm starting to find a place for both of them now.
Yeah, I suppose one thing I was digging in a little bit to the MFA at Glasgow School of Art is, I suppose I'm thinking more, perhaps generalising a bit, but when I think of ECA at that time, I think of somewhere where there were photographers teaching who are very passionate about the medium of photography, whereas at GSA and the MFA in particular, I think of ideas and very much more of a kind of open book in terms of the media that is used to put across an idea, to make a work. And so I'm just sort of thinking, I wonder what that did to you going from one to the other. But I think you've explained that really well.
It's also strange, Ben, because now I'm teaching on the BA Fine Art Photography course in Glasgow.
Yes.
I do see a more sort of seamless connection between that undergraduate course and the MFA there. Yeah, and I think in a way I did struggle initially from that switch from Edinburgh to Glasgow.
And your interest, I mean, sort of broadly speaking, there's a sort of passion for human rights, really. You started, I mean, you've mentioned that Playboy work, you're thinking about the representation of women quite early on. Where did that start? Or is it just something you felt that you were there came a certain point where you could bring that into your work, which we see sort of later on in more recent works you've made, and of course your PhD, which we'll come on to in a minute.
Yeah, I mean, I've never actually sought to describe it in that way. I suppose a work that I made prior to the PhD and after graduating from Glasgow are the relevant in this regard, because the most sort of overtly like political work I've made up until that point, I suppose. Again, I've never called it that before. But yeah, the work was titled Zero Hours.
Yes.
Yeah, which you generously exhibited through stills.
That's right.
And yeah, I mean, that work came about from my return to teaching and sort of the demands of the system that was working in. It was maybe something to do with my age, where I'd only ever worked in a, you know, in residencies or been in an educational setting where I had my own freedoms. But I saw staff members feeling increasingly squeezed by the lack of their own time for their research. It was something really integral to the role of teaching. And this seems like something that's only sort of intensifying as years go on in academia. But, you know, I was spent my time closely working with the first year students, and that was on an annual 0 hours contract. And in that job, I was giving a lot of these first year students their first experience in the darkroom. And I suppose the work that I ended up making came from a way of trying to express some of the frustrations of the 0 hours contract, but whilst also wanting to sort of celebrate the form and the joys and the process of the darkroom. You know, something that had really been a formative part of my educational experience. And the work, just to describe it visually, it's a collection of lumen prints or shadowgrams, and they've all been made from darkroom waste, from photographic paper that I picked out the bins and scanned and sort of represented or represented as abstract photographs. So yeah, I think I am seeing, as time goes on, being able to locate certain themes in my practice, and I never would have sort of drawn them all together. It can be quite helpful to do so. Yeah, sort of what you're asking about human rights or women's rights. I mean, I could talk about several different projects or strands of my research.
Yeah, I'd love to hear you. Yeah, if you don't mind, and I'd love you to mention the work that links the women abolitionists to Frederick Douglass.
Give me 1 second, then, sorry, my chair's creaking.
As you were talking there, I was just, I've finally got around to reading The Story of Looking, the book by Mark Cousins, which I thoroughly recommend. And I was just thinking there about, he writes really interestingly about the difference between lumen and lux and some of the sort of historical references for those things. Just got me thinking when you were describing your 0 hours work.
No, I've not read that yet. That sounds very relevant. Let me...
Do you want to start with Send Back the Money?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Send Back the Money. This is research. It's started a while back. I'm saying research because this is nothing that's taken the form of kind of a physical artwork in its own right, other than a banner that I made for a processions march that took place in Edinburgh and across the UK back in 2018. But yeah, Frederick Douglass, when Edinburgh Art Festival brought Douglass back to Scotland last summer in the work of Isaac Julian, I was really excited because he's someone I've been curious about for some time, maybe egotistically because of our shared name. I always had a curiosity or a deep discomfort about how his name came about, which was actually chosen by Douglass from a character in Sir Walter Scott's Lady of the Lake.
Right.
Yeah, but basically what's really interested me is his biography and the way it's bound up in the history of photography. So, you know, he's born into slavery around the same time of the invention of photography, and by 1846, as a free man, he's here in the UK and in Ireland, and he's delivering speeches to mass audiences, and he's educating them all on the systems and the brutality of slavery. It was actually after a walking tour in Glasgow, it was for Black History Month, it must be back in 2012 or something, that I first learned about Dunstan's time in Scotland. And I was just really keen to know what photographs might have existed, if any. I couldn't really visualise this guy here. And at this stage, I mean, this is pre-PhD before I started studying the history of photography, and I didn't know anything about his incredible writing on the topic either. But it's something that I just came to later. The placement that I mentioned at the V&A gave me a bit of time to do this, where I just started to piece together these moments in time between significant events, significant dates and events in Scottish photography, such as the portraits made by Hill and Adamson, and the sites in which Douglas gave his speeches. And just the proximity of these events were sort of blowing me away. Hill and Adamson's and Eggs, obviously, many of them being dated, so you could pinpoint these moments that they were actually working on Calton Hill.
Yeah.
And then you'd have Douglas at the Waterloo Rooms, 100 feet away, delivering his speeches.
That sort of Waterloo place?
That's right, yeah, and now Howie's restaurant. And he was invited on that occasion, and many of his other speeches. It was actually the Edinburgh Ladies Emancipation Society that gave Douglas his platform, and they were behind many of these campaigns in Scotland. Yeah, so Douglas, one of his main campaigns during the time was against the newly formed Free Church of Scotland, where he was criticising the ministers for accepting funds from American slaveholders. And the refrain that was used by Douglas and the supporters was "send back the money, send it back." And of course, those with the knowledge in the history of photography in Scotland know the significance of the Free Church and the groundbreaking calotypes that were made by Hill and Adamson. So yeah, just when starting to position the locations and these figures in relation to one another, I felt like I was starting to understand these photographs. I'd been studying for a long time, but understanding them on these new terms. And what became really significant were those who weren't represented, those who weren't photographed, like Douglas or the Edinburgh Ladies. And it kind of feels unfortunate for Scotland that there's no known calotype of the most photographed American of the 19th century, Frederick Douglass. I was really hoping one day in the archive something might fall out of an album. But yeah, I mean, the research into Douglass has actually been sort of a side interest, if you like. It doesn't probably fit neatly into the PhD, but that's kind of the beauty of the research. It takes in directions that you don't know you're heading in.
Sure, and clearly it demonstrates this interest. I mean, that whole thing about proximity is so interesting. But clearly you can see this interest in sort of hidden histories and uncovering things that have been completely overlooked, such as the role of women in photography.
Yeah.
I was thinking earlier about when I was at university studying the history of art, and the two key texts we were told to, you know, everyone went out to get or borrow from the library were Gombrich's The Story of Art and Janssen's The History of Art, both of which sort of famously, slightly depressingly, in the earlier editions, don't mention a single women artist. And I was thinking about that, but it leads me on to ask if you could, say something about your PhD and what you're looking in, what you're looking into, and perhaps some of the things you've uncovered so far.
Yeah, happily. Yeah, so like you say, it's really an interest in these less dominant narratives in the early history of photography. Or what I'm also looking at is proto-photography, you know, the years leading up to the invention. So, you know, initially my proposal was this focus on women and gender, and specifically the women that have been written out of this history. And that's not about female photographers per se, but, you know, about the assistants, the labourers, the pioneers, all of them, the contributions that have been written out. So yeah, but broadly it's a practice-based PhD that looks at this silencing of women in 19th century Scottish photography. and all of these untold roles in the formation of the discipline. And I'm looking at it as a sort of series of case studies, if you like. So it was a show at the National Museum of Scotland, the Victorian Sensation, curated by Sarah Stevenson and Alison Morrison Lowe back in 2015. It was that exhibition that really sparked the interest for this project. And I just thought the exhibition was incredible. The idea of it being on our doorstep and all of these instruments and these photographs were in reach in this building. I didn't really know much about them. So, you know, seeing a showcase of all of these pioneers of photography, and I really didn't appreciate the extent of this history of photography in Scotland. You know, I was teaching photography at the time. And just all of this really instigated what is now the current project. And it was at a symposium for that event. I was really questioning where the women were. What their role had been beyond the decorative or the consumer. Just really wanted to know more about them. So I've been looking at scientists working in the 18th century. There's the boundary crossing Elizabeth Fulham. She's a chemist and publishing in her time. And she's cited by John Herschel in one of his famous addresses on photography. It's amazing. She was doing all of this work from home in Edinburgh. So I kind of jokingly said when I started out, I'm going to prove that photography was invented by a Scottish woman. But there's moments you think, there's some truth to this. And yeah, I'm also looking at the subjects, like the photograph Fishwives of New Haven, the female workforce at George Washington Wilson in Aberdeen, and just what I'm calling the sort of underside of the history of photography, and try and bring that gendered and invisible labour into view through my work. And the work, I suppose it's the most developed, is that of the New Haven Fishwife.
Yeah.
And I just feel that the historical photograph subject occupies a really interesting position, and one that hasn't been written about extensively. I think that's changing. But for her to, the portrait of the fishwife, Elizabeth Johnson Hall, for that image to be singled out and written about by Walter Benjamin in his famous essay on photography, I was really struck that her biography hadn't really been explored at all. So yeah, that's one area that I've been working.
And there's a short film online of you talking about the Elizabeth Johnson Hall portrait and photograph you came across of her offering a slightly different gaze. That's the right, yeah. Could you say a little bit about that?
Sure. It was, so the Benjamin quote talks about Johnson Hall looking downwards in seductive shame. It's kind of prompted by this, I suppose. I started to make my own calotypes just to get a better understanding of the moment in time and the making of a calotype and what it entails. And clearly that bright sunlight that Helen Adamson used so dramatically and beautifully contributes to that effect where many of the subjects can't look at the camera directly. But yeah, it was in the making of my own calotypes. I got some training by, he calls himself a 21st century calotypist, Rob Douglas, again, no relation. But he was, it's remarkable what Rob's done. He's self-taught, and his teaching that he gave me was tailored to John Adamson's recipe that Robert Adamson would have used. So, you know, it's getting as close as I could to the procedure. And it was just extraordinary, you know, the whole process. Learned so much about the physicality and the labour in making these works.
Yeah.
How much washing is involved.
Would you mind saying a tiny bit about the process for?
Yeah, sure. Oh gosh, right. Rob will tear this apart if I get this wrong after my tuition was a few years ago. There's several steps to the process. So prior to even sensitizing the paper in preparation for the shooting, there's a day of preparation prior to that in which the teletype is made of a paper negative, so that's that needs to be iodized in advance. And then the day in which you're shooting, you sensitize that iodized paper. It's essentially salt and silver, the main components in this process. And it's based on William Henry Fox Talbot's invention. So these are the first reproducible photographs, because what you're creating is a paper negative. And from that paper negative, you create salt prints. So yeah, you have these sensitized paper negatives that really only remain sensitive for a short period of time. The shooting ideally has to be done that day.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were a subject who was photographed, say, by Helen Adamson, there would need to be a subsequent meeting arranged for you to see your positive print. You know, that couldn't all be done in the one day. I mean, it could be, but very, very unlikely that would happen. And yet what I found in the making of them, the models that I worked with, they didn't really recognize their photograph self when we were looking at the salt prints together. You know, they had these freckles that they'd never seen in their face before. Tattoos. One model had sleeves, tattoo sleeve on her arms, and they were completely removed by the time we were looking at the salt print positive. And it just, again, it has you reconsidering these pictures that you've been studying. Yeah, so sorry, Ben.
I threw you off track. You were
not at all.
Walter Benjamin and Elizabeth Johnson Hall portrait.
But yeah, it was in that process of making my own calotypes that I thought that there must be outtakes that I've not seen before. And so I went in search of an outtake of Johnson Hall, and like to my astonishment, found one in the Glasgow University collection.
Amazing.
And as I found one, of course, this has been archived and preserved by archivists and researchers before me, but it was just this kind of pursuit of a portrait that I hoped would exist, and there it was. And there was something about that, again, that kind of encounter with the portrait, and for her to return her gaze just felt extremely significant.
And a smile, am I right?
Exactly. Just all the kind of agency that I was hoping for suddenly coming into view. And, you know, there's been these, I mean, the works have been written about for some time now, and there's brilliant, you know, there's so much scholarship around them, and it makes them like hugely accessible, but at the same time, you feel definitely intimidated by that too. And I guess I've just been looking to find my contribution. Oddly, when I was presenting a paper at the V&A a few years back on Johnson Hall, a friend in the audience, Rose Teenby, she took a picture and tweeted it. And my mum saw this tweet, and she sent it back to me with a census. And she said, "You've got Johnson and Halls in the family." And she'd circled this census of a fishnet maker and basically all these relatives that are descendants from New Haven who have subsequently gone on to study. And it's just fascinating realizing that you're very distantly related to some of the subjects you've been studying.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah.
but as are probably half of Leith. You know, not making grand claims here. It's just when you actually do that archival research, it's really incredible what you start to uncover. And of course, Hill and Adamson make that extremely easy for me, in that they actually named the working class sitters. You know, in these albums, there's different editions, but in certain albums, in Johnson Hall's case, her name is written underneath her portrait. And there is something really moving about going to the National Records of Scotland with Roddy Simpson, a great Scottish historian of early photography. And we looked at these census records from 1841, 1851, and we were able to find them with ease. You know, we're circling these subjects that were all photographed down in New Haven, just getting a sense of their lives and occupations and everything else.
Was that unusual, do you think, for the photographer to include a name?
Yes.
Yeah.
A scholar who's looked at these works, she describes it as a radical act. And I think I'm in total agreement with this. You see, like, the earliest photographic club in the world, or is often named as such. I know it's always problematic to name firsts. The Edinburgh Calotype Club.
Mm-hmm.
They have fishwives in their collection. But, you know, these portraits, it couldn't be more different. They're made at the same moment in time, but they're from a distance. There's a known naming of the subjects. It's much more in keeping with other sort of hobbyists and photographers of that period in their treatment of working people, if you like. So, yeah, I guess talking here about the agency of the subject and what studying that, what that does to the our understanding of the photographic history when we pay attention to the subject like that.
What are you looking at now, or what's next for you in terms of PhD studies and other things, exhibition opportunities and that sort of thing? Have you got things planned, or are you really just concentrating on the PhD at the moment?
Yeah, I've got a couple of projects on the go at the moment. I mentioned the placement that I undertook at Collective last year.
Yes.
So that came about when the Collective, you know, they announced their plans to expand their footprint on Calton Hill, and they're going to be working with Observatory House. So that's the 18th century residential home on Calton Hill. And I couldn't believe it. I'd been like studying this very building in my research. Obviously, Calton Hill's got great significance in the early history of photography, but this site being one of them. Yeah, so I worked there as a resident artist and researcher, and I was given access to the house with the support of Siobhan Carroll. So it was when it was undergoing all of its architectural developments by Collective. But it was really, I felt like such privileged access, and I was recreating a camera obscura in a site that had once had one. So you've got this dome ceiling, which has sort of been filled in. There's no longer any lens or apparatus in there. But I just made my own sort of very rudimentary camera obscura with the aperture on one window, blacking everything out. And it exists at the moment as a video work. Yeah, I'm working with some different phrases, like the woman who had her camera obscura on Calton Hill in her promotional or sort of pamphlets that would advertise it. She talked about the sublime truths of science are no longer confined to the wealthy and the learned. And I love this, the idea of this popular observatory for the people. I've been making my own popular observatory and doing a bit durational writing whilst I was there. So I'm just working that through at the moment. Yeah, her camera obscura was actually demolished in 1851. The camera obscura that sits at the top of, is it Castle Terrace, at the top of the Royal Hill?
Yep.
That's where she relocated, also died there, in fact.
I didn't realise, I didn't know that, yeah.
No, I mean, nor did I. And it was only something I sort of learned a year or two into the PhD as well. But yeah, there's figures like Maria Short, like Elizabeth Fulham, the chemist that I mentioned. The more recent work that I'm doing at the moment is inspired by Mary Somerville, the more famous Scottish scientist. But I'm hoping to prove her role in the history of photography is actually very significant. And I've been making some anthotypes, because that's a method that Somerville had pioneered and researched with John Herschel.
Right.
And anthotypes in their very nature are made from petals and vegetable juices, and they're not fixable. So there's no Somerville works, if you like, to actually examine. So I'm making my own. But yeah, I've got a group show coming up next month in London. It's with fellow researchers at the RCA. Mm-hmm. And I'll be showing some of the anthotypes then. But long-term, Ben, I'm coming back home, and that's where I want to have my Viva exhibition, you know, where the research has been primarily based.
Yeah.
I just need to write it all and make it all first.
And that place in Scotland being Edinburgh, or
that's right. Yeah.
Yeah,
definitely.
With Glasgow and St Andrew's collections in there somewhere as well, I imagine. But
yeah, and Aberdeen,
yeah.
Dundee, that's right.
Right. Yeah. That's really interesting. I didn't realise that there'd been such a long history of a camera obscura as a kind of visitor attraction in Edinburgh. Mm. As far as I know, it's still really, extremely well visited today, like you say, up towards the castle.
Yep.
That's really interesting. And I should mention to everyone again, this, your video of the camera obscura collective from Carlton Hill is on your website as well. I love that title, The Sublime Truths of Science Are No Longer Confined to the Wealthy and the Learned.
Here.
Yeah.
And I hate to break it to you, Ben, but you know, with stills being positioned on Coburn Street, it was Lord Coburn that saw about the demolition of Short's camera obscura. I'm digging up all sorts of him.
Yeah.
keep you posted.
Please do. I'd love to know more about this street too, because I do know that there were commercial photographers on this street at the very early 1900s, I think late 1800s as well. There was one on the corner a bit further up the street above what is now a coffee shop. I think it was Alan Dimmick who told me that. But certainly at a period of time, there were so many commercial photographers working in Edinburgh along Prince's Street and so on. And I think I learned that from the Victorian Sensation exhibition that you've mentioned at the National Museum. It was so interesting. And like you say, there was so much material, very informative catalogue and writing around the exhibition.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. The publication took alongside it, I think there was two versions, but the hardback, the extended one is really worth reading any listeners that are interested.
Caroline, thank you so much for your time. It's really good to speak to you, and so interesting to hear what you're doing now and what you've done. And I hope folk can head to your website to find out a bit more, and look forward to seeing will your exhibition at the Royal College of Art be on for a while, or is it one of these sort of short week or 2 weeks?
Yeah, it's a very short one, just for a couple of weeks. But there will be other shows in Scotland and all.
Good.
But thank you, Ben. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks again, and really look forward to seeing you soon.
Cheers.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to my conversation with the artist Caroline Douglas about her artistic practice and the research she's undertaken into the role of women in early Scottish photography. If you'd like to hear more episodes, you can subscribe for free. Photography Down the Line is hosted by Anchor, but available on various other platforms, including Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much for listening.